Matthew chapter 5, verse 27. You've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it's better for you to lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. Now, people hear that passage and they go, yep, that's what I thought. That's what Christians think. Any hint of desire and I'm going to hell. But if you've been here the last few weeks as we've been studying the Sermon on the Mount, what you know is that at this point in Jesus's message, in his sermon, he's sort of going back and forth with the Mosaic Law. He's sort of jazzing, he's riffing on the Mosaic Law. And so he'll say, you've heard it said, whatever, but I say to you, and he sort of expounds on how he interprets the Old Testament law. And right here in this passage, he affirms the seventh commandment, which is thou shalt not commit adultery. And earlier in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus affirms the entire Old Testament moral law when he said, I didn't come to abolish it. I came to fulfill it. And when Jesus affirms the moral law of the Mosaic law, the moral aspect of the Mosaic law, he's also within that, he's affirming the Old Testament sexual ethic, which essentially is for Jesus to say that the design for sex for those who are committed to the life of the way of God is that sex is meant to be shared within a marriage covenant of a husband and a wife. And anything outside of that, God does not endorse or bless. And in fact, he even categorizes it as a form of adultery. But inside the marriage covenant, the Old Testament teaches and Jesus affirms that sex is a beautiful gift that God blesses. In fact, people, there's this belief that Christians or that the Bible is like anti-sex. Absolutely not. The Bible is very pro-sex. In fact, Tim Keller, who used to pastor in Manhattan, says there are parts of the Bible that will make even New Yorkers blush. Okay, read Song of Songs, but not to your children until they're ready, okay? The biblical sexual ethic is that according to the scriptures, sex was designed by God to be a covenant sealing act of whole life entrustment to another person. That a husband and a wife would commit the fullness of themselves to one another in an exclusive, permanent, one flesh relationship that is unbreakable until death. And I know that this view has fallen out of favor with our culture. I'm aware of that. I know that it's seen as absurd, it's seen as primitive, it's seen as regressive, and in some minds, it's seen as even dangerous. And you might even think that. And I want to say, you're welcome here. You're welcome to doubt. You're free to disagree with me. You're welcome to ask questions. And I hope that you receive no sense of judgment from me or from anyone else. But I am more convinced than ever that the teaching of the Bible and the teaching of Jesus and the witness of the church for 2,000 years affirms that God's design for sex is that it is to be enjoyed within a marriage covenant. I mean, in our wedding vows, this is what we say. I commit to have and to hold, forsaking all others as long as we both shall live. Another way to say that is to say, I will never give myself in this way to anyone but you until one of us dies. That's what you're saying when you say the traditional marriage vows. And if we believe that this is God's design for sex, then it becomes obvious that not only is adultery not a part of that design, but adultery is an absolute devastation of that design. And I know you might be thinking, here we go, another Christian preacher talking about sex, how hypocritical. And you'd be right. I can name you numerous high-profile Christian leaders who have been found guilty of adultery, of sexual abuse, and any other sexual misbehavior that you can imagine. And what you need to know is that Jesus hates self-righteousness and hypocrisy just as much as he does adultery, if not more. But before you cast stones, you must realize that in the eyes of Jesus, adultery and hypocrisy is not someone else's sin. It's all of ours. And this is why he says, you have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. I want us to see the problem of lust this morning. You warmed up yet? I'm talking about this stuff? I am. Yeah, I'm sweating. Some of you may be familiar with King David. He was alone one night. You may be familiar with this story. He was king of Israel. He was alone one night, perhaps in Jerusalem, looking over the city skyline, and he saw a married woman bathing on her rooftop. He lusted after her. He called her into his palace. He committed adultery. He got her pregnant, and then he murdered her husband to cover it all up. And a year or so later, David thought he got away with it. And then he married her. He thought, oh, this is great. I got away with it. And a year or so later, a court prophet named Nathan came to David and said, through an allegorical story, he said, David, there is a man who has coveted, lusted, stolen, and murdered something that did not belong to him. What shall we do? And David is the king, the executor of justice, and he says, this man, whoever he is, must pay. He must be tried. He must be found guilty. And David even says he must be executed. And he said, who is this man so that we can go find him? And Nathan says, David, it's you. You're the man. Like, you're the man. Normally, that's like a positive thing. You're the man. Like, you don't want to hear that from Nathan. But when we talk about adultery or any sexual sin, we're often so quick to judge. Look at those people. Look at what they're doing. Look at them. But Jesus, right here on the Sermon on the Mount, says, you are those people. You are the man, Jesus is saying. This is his you are the man moment for us. And what Jesus is saying is adultery and sexual immorality is not someone else's problem. It's all of ours. And Jesus gets to the heart of the matter. And he said, just like he did with anger and murder last week, he said, you may have never murdered somebody, but if you've had anger in your heart towards someone, the seed that leads to murder is already there in you. And he says the same thing here. He says the seed of adultery is in all of us. Even if you've never committed the sexual act of adultery, even if you've never committed a sexual act at all, we have all lusted in our hearts, which when Jesus says, when it comes to the heart, lust is not that much different than the act itself. And I want us to see the difference, though, between lust and desire, lest you think I'm saying more than I am. A lot of people read this passage of Jesus and they think that the only way to respond is to repress our sexual desires. But Jesus does not want us to come to the conclusion that we are to repress our sexual desires. Jesus doesn't say that sexual desire or attraction is bad. Those are good things. He says lust is sinful. And we're often embarrassed, at least in the church, by our sexual desires. Yet God gave them to us. See, to be sexual is not the opposite of being holy. See, it's not lust if you find someone attractive. It's not lust if you desire to have sex. It's not lust to experience sexual temptation. Lust is how you respond to those experiences. Let me give an example that might help. Let's say men. Men, let's say you're watching a movie or you're watching television and an actress comes on the screen and she's beautiful. Like there's no way, I mean, you can't get around it. She's beautiful. She's attractive. It's okay to notice that. Like, it's okay to notice that the actress is attractive, but if after seeing the actress, you pull out your phone and you do a Google search, or you pull out your Instagram and you find her profile and you start looking intently at her photos and you let your mind move from attractiveness to sexual fantasy, at that point, it's become a real problem because it has become an act of betrayal on your spouse or perhaps even your future spouse. And when you've done that, the seed of adultery has now been placed in your heart. And once that seed has been planted, all that you lack is the opportunity to act on it. And women, it can be you're flipping through the channels and, you know, post-game interview of Cam Newton or J.J. Watt, and they're in the locker room and they're shirtless. And, I mean, or it could be a novel that you've read. One thing, it's seeing something, noticing that someone is attractive is not sinful. But what you do with the next step of that attraction is what can lead you into lustful intent. One thing my wife and I do when we're watching movies together, if there's a really attractive actress or actor on television, what we'll do is if we're watching the movie and if you know this actress or actor comes on the screen and they're wearing something provocative or some, you know, buff guy takes his shirt off, we immediately will pull the blanket up over our heads. If it's a really attractive guy, I pull the blanket up over her head. And if it's a really attractive woman, she pulls the blanket up over my head. And then sometimes we'll just kiss each other. Because what we both recognize is that in that moment when we've seen that on that screen, that some level of sexual desire has been activated. And before that attraction can turn into lust, we stop the other person. And at times we will redirect that desire back to each other. I have three kids, you know. It's cold in here. Because we know that to let those thoughts be directed toward anyone outside of the covenant that we've made to one another would be an act of betrayal. Listen, if I knew, or if I thought that my wife was lying in bed at night thinking of Christian Grey and fantasizing about the novel, she hasn't read it, but if I had any thought that maybe she was lying in bed fantasizing about another man, it would crush me. And likewise, if my wife, her heart would be broken if she knew that I was fantasizing about any other woman besides her. So let me give you a definition of lust. Desire is not bad. God has given us desire. But let me give you a definition of lust. The sin of lust is constructing a sexual relationship in your head that does not involve your spouse, listen, or the consent of the one that you're lusting after. So therefore, lust is both an act of betrayal on your spouse or your future spouse, and an act of selfish consumption that uses another person who did not consent for you, them to be used in that way in your head for your personal pleasure. And I want you to see, the second thing I want us to see today is the personal and social costs of lust. You know, one of the most obvious areas in our culture where lust is an issue, where it's become normalized, is pornography. And today, pornography is more accessible than it's ever been, and it has created a pandemic. It used to be that you had to go to a seedy convenience store in like a back alley somewhere and endure the shame of asking the clerk to get that magazine behind the counter. But today, it can be accessed at any time, anywhere, and it has been normalized. We say things like, oh, that's just what guys need to do to blow off steam. And it's been normalized to the point that I'm convinced that what my grandparents called pornography, we call HBO. And we sit on our couches sometimes with people from our small group at church with popcorn in our lap and we watch it. It's become so normalized that we don't even recognize it anymore. And what was once mostly a men's issue has now become just as much of an issue with women, statistically speaking. And there's a myth that pornography is harmless, that it doesn't affect anybody else. But that could not be further from the truth, because there have been numerous sociological, neuroscience, psychological studies on the social costs of pornography, particularly on those who view it, but also on women, children, families, and even communities. The Witherspoon Institute referenced a study done by numerous psychologists, which reveals, it basically says the neuroscience is revealed by empirical studies, and it says this, that porn use undermines marital and dating relationships. It can actually make men sexually incompetent with a real partner. And it can lead to a growing attraction to images that are hardcore in nature, which often include violence. If you actually go and listen to Ted Bundy's last interview before he was executed, he traces that sick desire in his mind to rape and murder, traces it back to pornography. He said, I was chasing an image that would give me a greater high, an image that would give me a greater high, an image. And they got so hardcore and violent in nature that the only way to experience the pleasure that I once did when I first started was to actually go out and rape and murder someone. It's an addiction. It's like heroin. For women, it leads to growing expectations that are impossible for any woman to live up to, whether in their appearance or in the bedroom. For adolescent boys, studies show that boys who view pornography early in life, have an increased chance of being violent and sexually abusive toward their peers. For adolescent girls, they are more inclined who view pornography or are surrounded by adolescent boys that do view pornography. Adolescent girls are more inclined to tolerate emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. I have friends who are student pastors, and you would not believe the things that young girls today, 10, 11, and 12 years old, believe that they have to do in order to get the attention of boys in their class. And furthermore, many studies have revealed that there is a connection between the porn industry and human trafficking and sexual exploitation. You see, as pornography use increases, sexual exploitation becomes necessary to keep up with the demand. Sex slavery is a reality, not just in the red light districts of Amsterdam or Bangkok, but in the United States. I used to live an hour and a half from Atlanta. Atlanta is the sex slavery capital of North America. Men, when you are using pornography, you are aiding and championing and paying for this level of injustice. Pornography is harmless. It's not hurting anybody else. You're wrong. You're so wrong. I came across an article this week titled, An Open Letter to My Porn-Watching Dad from Your Daughter. Men, how would you like to receive that letter? I sobbed as I read it. It is not a harmless thing. And here's the thing. Our culture is so confused right now when it comes to sex and anything like this. Because on the one hand, we want to believe that the sexual revolution is some progressive march toward freedom. But then at the same time, we're reckoning as a country with the effects of the sexual revolution right now. Rape on college campuses is on the rise. Sexual abuse in virtually every form is on the rise. And we as a culture want to say, sexual revolution, march toward this progressive view of freedom. But then at the same time, we shake our heads and wonder why all these women are coming forward saying they've been raped. Listen, you raise a generation of boys on pornography and then act shocked when they feel entitled to abuse women or young boys. Why are we shocked by this? We fed this to ourselves. And you may think Jesus' words about lust and sex are harsh, and you may even think that the Bible's sex ethic is repressive, but I promise you, if every man in America took to heart Jesus' words right here in the Sermon on the Mount, there would be no Me Too movement. We wouldn't be in the mess that we're in today, and lives would not be destroyed like they had been if we would just take Jesus at His word. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, He's addressing the issues of His day. But I imagine if Jesus were right here in New York right now doing a Q&A with our neighbors, and if somebody asked Him about the sexual abuse culture that seems to be rampant right now in our country and the Me Too movement and all this stuff that's going on in our world right now, I think Jesus would say to us, you've heard it said, do not sexually abuse someone. But I say to you, if you've looked on another person with lust in your heart, you've committed sexual abuse. Because that's where it begins. See, don't you see that Jesus' commands aren't laid out to restrict us from joy, but to bring joy to us, but to bring freedom for us. And Jesus said, somebody asked Him, what's the greatest commandment, Jesus? Jesus said, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But He also said, all commands flow from that. Every command in the Bible flows from love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And so, which means that by fleeing from lust, we are actually loving God and loving our neighbor. Because lust is not a private sin. It's a public one. And lust at its very core is an act of not loving your neighbor well. Jesus says we must put lust to death. He says, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out. Throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body goes into hell. This statement has been misunderstood over the years. It's important to note that Jesus is using hyperbole here. He's not speaking literally. Jesus does not want you to cut off your hand or your eye or your any other body part for that matter, because Jesus actually says in other places, he says, it's not, your sin doesn't come from outside you. It's actually what comes from the inside, comes from your heart. Jesus is not saying, Jesus is under no illusions that if you cut your eye out, you're going to stop lusting. You still got an imagination. You're still going to use it. What Jesus is saying, kill your sin before it kills you. Kill it before it kills you, even if you have to take drastic measures. And this is where churches often get into legalism, when they're like, well, this is what it means to cut off your hand. Listen, this looks different for every person, what it means to kill their sin, because all of us have a different threshold when it comes to sexual temptation. I know, but what you've got to deal with in your own heart is, what are the things that trigger lust and immoral, evil thoughts in my mind? What are the things that trigger that, and then do away with those things? My college roommate, for example, understood that he had a lust issue. And it had, for a season, become a porn issue on occasion. And he wanted to kill that habit in his life before he got married, because he knew he didn't want that to spill into his marriage. And he literally took the door off of his hinges. Like, he didn't have a door. And he moved, this is back when we had desktop computers, you know? You guys remember, they were huge. And he moved that into the living room, and he taped right above the monitor Proverbs 7:22, which says, like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into the noose. See, he knew that his threshold for temptation was very low, so he fought it accordingly. Took the door off his hinges. For me, when I first got married, I thought, you know, like many young guys do, I thought, you know what, I've got this issue, I've got this, got these thoughts, these lustful desires, but when I get married, it's all going to go away. And I realized very quickly when I got married that my lust issues didn't dissipate like I thought they would. And so I knew that I would need to put safeguards in my life. So I reached out to a friend who, to this day, still through a program I have on my computer, my phone, my iPad, and any other device you can imagine, he sees my internet history gets emailed to him. He can see everything. I can't delete it after I do it. I mean, it gets sent to him in real time. And also, my wife has all of my passwords. She can log in to any account, any device, any app at any time, anywhere. And I allow that because it safeguards me. And I don't know what that looks like for you. Maybe the measures have to be more drastic, or they don't have to be quite as drastic. But Rich Velotis, my friend, a pastor in Queens, he says, Jesus doesn't suggest Band-Aids to cover our sin. He commands amputations. Whatever is causing you to sin, Jesus is saying, get rid of it. And you may think that that little office flirting is just a little thing. It's not a big deal. I'm not going to commit adultery. I'm not going to say I love my spouse. You might think that's a little thing, but that is much more dangerous than you think. Jesus says, cut it out. Cut it off. Quit your job if you have to. Find another one. It's not worth it. And Jesus is asking us, is there a book, a website, an app, a device, a relationship that is it worth your entire life? He says, cut it off. Delete Facebook. Oh, but it's how I keep in touch. Delete it. Jesus knows the ways that we corrupt our souls and our relationships with others. And he says it would be better to go into the kingdom of God with some of our desires unfulfilled than to go to hell with all of our desires fulfilled. Dale Bruner says it is infinitely better to go limping into the kingdom of heaven than go leaping into hell. And let's talk about the path to freedom. That's heavy, I know. And trust me, I don't take any pleasure in preaching this sermon. My wife can tell you, I've lost sleep all week over this. But there's a path to freedom. So far in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has called us murderers and adulterers. He says, if you've been angry at someone, you're guilty of murder in your heart and in the eyes of God. If you've ever lusted, you're guilty of adultery in your heart and in the eyes of God. And so Jesus is essentially saying, and there's all these religious leaders around him at this time, and Jesus is essentially saying to these guys who were cocky and thought that God just loved them because they were so awesome, Jesus is saying, if you think you have any righteousness to stand on, you have none. You need grace. There is no room in the church for self-righteousness toward anyone. Jesus says we all need to worry about the log in our own eye before we even consider the speck in someone else's. And so how do we remove the log in our eye? How do we find freedom in this area? And how do we address our lustful hearts? And I would say it like this. To flee from sin means that we must run to something greater. In the earlier part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, I believe it's no coincidence that Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," before he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart." Because Jesus knew that we couldn't pursue purity of heart until we first knew how poor in spirit we are. And when we hear the words of Jesus and we reflect on our own lives and our own hearts, we should all be convicted in some way when we read this passage. And it hurts because we don't like to think of ourselves as adulterous. But it is when we recognize our sinfulness, that is when we can run to the grace and the mercy of God. We can receive his forgiveness, receive his spirit, the one who gives us the power to pursue holiness. Listen, before you can be free from this sin, you must first experience God's forgiveness. But you must know first that you're forgiven before you can pursue freedom. See, the only way to experience freedom in this area of your life, the attraction of lust, can only be overcome by being attracted to something more beautiful than that which tempts you. We need to fix our gaze on something that is greater, something that is more beautiful than the sin that entices us. I remember when I was in college, I had to read Greek mythology. Not my favorite genre of literature. I've tried later in life to get back. It's just, I can't, you know. But I do remember one story called Jason and the Argonauts. Does anyone remember that? Of course you do. These men, they're traveling by ship. They're on a mission. But one of the great challenges of the sea that they were traveling was this group of seductive creatures called the Sirens, which were like half women, half bird creatures. And these creatures would sit on the shore and they would sing these beautiful songs as these ships would come by. And the songs were so beautiful and they were so seductive. They were magical in a way, and they would enchant the sailors. And the sailors like wouldn't know what to do. Like their eyes would start like, you know, like the spinning, and they're like, whoa, you know, like a cartoon. And they would jump overboard and they would start swimming to the sirens. But what would happen is they would all jump overboard. The ships would crash on the rocks and the sirens would disappear and they would all drown in the ocean. And so that which was seducing them was actually killing them. And they had heard stories of this happening, but they had a secret weapon. They had a man named Orpheus on the ship with them, who was the son of Muse. He was an extraordinary musician, and he could play the lyre, he could play the harp, and he could sing like nobody else in the world. And so when they began to hear the songs of the sirens, they said, "Orpheus, get to work." And Orpheus pulls out the harp and he starts playing beautifully and he starts singing louder and more loudly and more beautifully than the sirens were singing. He played a better song than that of the sirens, and the men tuned themselves to what Orpheus was playing. And they were able to sail past the seductive songs that led to death because they were listening to the one song that gave life. And when we are enticed by the seductive songs of our own hearts, what we need is we need a more beautiful song to tune into. Hebrews 12:24 says, "Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant and the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than all the empty words on this earth." Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart," meaning those who turn from lust, "for they will" what? "See God." What's more beautiful? What would you rather look at? Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. See, the answer to lust is not try harder or stop or even put internet filters on. The answer to lust is to find something more attractive, something more beautiful, more life-giving. And we can find victory over this sin and any other sin by seeing the greater beauty in Jesus. When we look at Jesus, here's what we find. we find a man who knows our thoughts. He knows the things that no one else knows. John 2:24 says that Jesus knows what is in every person. Jesus knows the things that are in you. He knows the thoughts in your mind that if anyone else knew, they would run away from you. But Jesus doesn't run away from you. He runs toward you. He lived a life completely free from lust. He was tempted just like you and me, but he did not sin. Yet he died the death of an adulterer. He took your sin upon himself. He took it from you, and you are no longer guilty of adultery or lust or anything because Jesus took your guilt from you on the cross. That is a more beautiful story than any porn film could ever dream of telling. And so the question for us today is, would we take our eyes off of our lustful fantasies and fix them on Jesus and find joy? Because that rush that you're looking for when you turn on the computer screen, that level of approval that you're seeking when you flirt with your coworker, that feeling that you're looking for when you read that novel, all of those feelings are cheap imitations of what Jesus gives you. He gives you approval. He gives you joy. He gives you embrace. He gives you acceptance. He forgives. He restores. He loves. And no matter what your thought history, what your internet history, what your sexual history, no matter what you did yesterday, Jesus looks at you and he loves you. He cleanses you. He restores you. And he says, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. All of you who want so badly to be unentangled from this sin that just seems to have a hold of you like barbed wire, come to me and you'll find rest. No matter what your sexual past, no matter what desires or fantasies that you have entertained in your head or in your life, you need to know that Jesus loves you. He still moves toward you. He still embraces you. And just like he said to the woman that was caught in adultery, he looks at you now and says, go and sin no more. Go and sin no more. First, know that you've been forgiven, and then go and be free.